Welcome to the Top Secret edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us. There's no question that things are tense between the U.S. and Russia today, not unlike the Cold War. Back in the 1950s, President Eisenhower stared down the Soviet Union over the nuclear arms race that threatened to destabilize the world. Writer and historian Evan Thomas told this story and painted a lively portrait of the former president in his book, Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World. I spoke with him back in 2012. Let's take a listen. It's interesting to think of Eisenhower going from general, a very popular general, coming back to the U.S. in the 1950s. You say he had a kind of disdain for politics, probably didn't even vote. Why did he want to be president of the United States?
He said he disdained politics, but of course he was a great politician. You don't get to be Supreme Allied Commander unless you're pretty good at politics. He had an instinctive feel for it. He felt that he was, in a way, the most popular guy in the world in 1945, all over the world.
Sure.
And he felt that as the communist threat was building and the country was in danger, he felt a sense of duty. I know that sounds kind of melodramatic and really egotistical, but he saw a sense of duty. He used to carry around a poem called The Indispensable Man, that he was indispensable, that he really was the guy who could save the country. He wasn't totally wrong in that.
But was his overall goal to prevent another world war or prevent the nuclear annihilation of the world, to be dramatic here?
His first day in office, his desk drawer is locked. They get a key. There's a report in it written by Robert Oppenheimer, who developed the atom bomb. And he said, the United States and the Soviet Union are about to reach what they call nuclear plenty. Each side will be able to put 2,500 bombs on the other, and civilization as we know it is going to cease to exist. The United States and the Soviet Union, said Oppenheimer, are like two scorpions in a bottle waiting to sting each other to death. That was the burden on Dwight Eisenhower. He actually considered, in his first several months, doing a preemptive strike on the Soviet Union before they got enough bombs to kill us. That was the atmosphere of the time, and Eisenhower saw himself as a peacemaker. He had seen war. He hated war. Like a lot of real warriors, he hated war, and he was damn sure he was going to avoid any war to keep us out of a nuclear war.
But what's so interesting is that he threatened nuclear annihilation as kind of perverse or inverse way of trying to keep
peace.
He
did. It's hard to get your arms around or your head around. But you have to look at the way he did. He had seen a lot of war, obviously, World War II, and his reading of Clausewitz on war, he was actually surprisingly intellectual, was that small wars become big wars. That politicians who think they can control little wars are kidding themselves.
And there's some truth to that, isn't
there?
Yeah,
oh, absolutely, as we have found out to our displeasure,
yes,
to our pain. Anyways, he saw that, and so he didn't want to get involved in any war. But he's not a pacifist. Communism seems to be on the march in that time. You look at a map, Eastern Europe turns red, China turns red, it's, you know, Southeast Asia, it's everywhere. And the United States is not going to just go home. So he sees these confrontations coming with the Soviets. He doesn't want to fight with them conventional weapons because he thinks that'll get out of control. What are you going to do? He bluffs. He bluffs with nuclear weapons. He basically says, don't try us, don't even think about it, or we're going all the way. And so that, for instance, when Berlin, you know, which is sort of a hot point of the Cold War, and the Russians were trying to kick the West out of Berlin, looks like there's a crisis, 1958, 1959, Eisenhower says to his cabinet, you know, he uses a poker analogy. We're not going to be starting with the white chips, you know, conventional troops going up to the blue chips, nuclear bombs. I'm putting my whole stack into play, was the expression he used. It's all or nothing. That's the only strategy I have. And he said, this is not going to be some nice, sweet World War II kind of war. So he played this kind of heavy hand. Now, only Dwight Eisenhower could get away with something like this. You had to be this supreme Allied commander, this general who'd won World War II to get away with this bluff. But he did. Now, what's so interesting to me, he carried all this in his head alone. He didn't share this with anybody. He didn't tell anybody. I started writing this book because I heard that his closest aide, General Goodpaster, said, you know, Eisenhower never told us if and when he'd used these weapons. Mm. He kept this all to himself. I thought, wow, what is that like to carry that kind of responsibility?
Well, on the one hand, you have to have supreme confidence in your position, but you also have to think that the other side will blink.
Yes, you right? sure do. He called the bluff of the Soviet Union. Khrushchev, your listeners will remember Nikita Khrushchev, who was a very scary, blustery guy, would say, "We will bury you," and pounded the table at the UN with his shoe and talk about having rockets and all that kind of stuff. Khrushchev was a scary guy, but Eisenhower knew how to deal with him. And the way to deal with him was not to back down and to meet him and to talk to him. And he gradually got Khrushchev to calm down. But he could only do that from a position of strength. Khrushchev was only going to understand it if Ike was backed by real rockets, by real missiles.
You also say that Eisenhower really was his own Secretary of Defense. He had a Secretary of State. He had a CIA director, but sort of acted or operated as his own Secretary of Defense.
He did. He did. This is a good thing about Eisenhower that people overlook. Eisenhower knew the military. He actually cut defense spending in the 1950s. Think about it. This is very counterintuitive. The great general, when we're building up for the Cold War, cut defense spending. Now, he did it from a high level of the Korean War, but he cut it. He did it while building an enormous Strategic Air Command and missile fleet. He did it by cutting his own army, his own service. Now, it takes a pretty big ego and pretty big confidence to do that, to irritate, to put it mildly, annoy your old comrades in arms from World War II. Matthew Ridgway quit as Army Chief of Staff because he couldn't bear Eisenhower's cutting of the army, because he knew the Pentagon, and only like nobody else did, he was able to cut it.
The idea of cutting it, if you cut it, then you won't use it? I mean, was that his thinking, which sounds Absolutely. Rather simplistic?
Yes. But... For instance, when they're having this great to-do over Berlin in 1958, and Khrushchev has issued an ultimatum. The West must be out in 6 months. And everybody's going, we have to build up our conventional forces and get ready to fight. Eisenhower cut conventional forces in Berlin by 50,000. Oh. And nobody could believe it. What are you doing? And what he was doing was he was bluffing with nuclear weapons. We're not going to have a conventional war. It's all or nothing. He called Khrushchev's bluff.
Let me ask you about the Dulles brothers, John Foster Dulles, head of the Secretary of State, and Alan Dulles heading up the CIA. What was their relationship with each other, and what was Eisenhower's relationship with the two of them?
Well, a lot of power to have both the Secretary of State and the CIA in one family, so to speak, a brother act. And the CIA was very aggressive and involved in the 1950s. And Eisenhower was fine with that because, since he didn't want to fight conventional wars, he used the CIA to fight secret wars on the cheap, small. At first, it looked like it was going okay. Coups in Iran and Guatemala. Now, in retrospect, those coups were a disaster. But at the time, it looked like it was a kind of cheap, simple way to check communism. As the 50s went on, the CIA had less success. There were failed coups in Syria and Indonesia. And Eisenhower, in retrospect, should have fired Alan Dulles. But he doesn't. And it's because he says it takes a strange kind of genius, as he says, to run the CIA. And Alan Dulles was that kind of a genius, a great spy in World War II. But also because his brother is Secretary of State. And it's a little bit hard to get rid of one brother without getting rid of the other. And Ike liked John Foster. So I think this is a failure on Ike's part. He should have gotten rid of Alan Dulles and exercised greater control over the CIA. It comes back to bite Ike because the CIA withholds the fact that the Soviets are building anti-aircraft missiles that can shoot down our U-2 spy plane. This is important because we got this great U-2 spy plane going over Russia. The Russians can't touch it for a long time, but then they can. And they actually do shoot one down right on the eve of this summit meeting in 1960. And it's a terrible blow to Eisenhower because he thinks he wants to have this summit to get with Khrushchev, to create detente, to cool off the Cold War. Once that U-2 is shot down, Khrushchev makes a big show of, we've captured the pilot and all that. It's the end of detente. The Cold War begins a very dangerous period. So the CIA really let down Eisenhower by not telling him the truth about what the Russians could do.
But as you say, looking back at some of those small war, cold wars of the 1950s, even in the 60s, you can see their legacy today.
You can, and it's unfortunate. I mean, even in the 50s, people started to suspect the CIA was everywhere.
Exactly.
It's those Yankees, the CIA. And so it made us seem like a more malevolent power than we actually were. We could be a malevolent power in some ways, but not nearly the degree much of the so-called Third World, as we called it in those days, thought we were. So it had an unfortunate legacy.
You quote John Foster Dulles, who seemed to enjoy the kind of brinksmanship that Eisenhower was about.
He did. I mean, it was a complicated relationship. Eisenhower used Dulles in a good cop, bad cop way. He let Eisenhower let Dulles be the kind of heavy, say, you know, massive retaliation, brinksmanship. And the press, which was lazy in those days, maybe even lazier than today, thought that Dulles was making foreign policy. He wasn't. Eisenhower was. But it was useful for Eisenhower to let Dulles be the front man, even though, as we now know, Eisenhower was writing the key words in the speech.
Dulles saying, just as you must take chances in war, the ability to get to the verge without getting into war is the necessary art. If you cannot master it, you inevitably go to war, basically saying what Eisenhower believed.
But it's all kind of blustery at the time, and people thought, oh, my God, they're going to get us all killed. And Eisenhower just sat back playing golf and, you know, seeming kind of dopey, and, well, you better talk to Foster about that. But Eisenhower was running the show.
I do remember because I was a kid in elementary school in the 1950s, the kind of, you know, duck and cover.
Yeah.
The silliness, in hindsight, obviously, duck and cover
didn't feel so silly at the time, did it?
No, but it was a scary time.
It was scary. It was. I'm born in 1951, so I grew up in the same period, and I was scared to death.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we were allowed to be too scared. I think Eisenhower probably could have done a better job out of reassuring us that the Soviet missiles were not about to fly. But, you know, it was the time, and planners always make for worst-case scenarios, and the Soviet threat was real. It wasn't imagined. I mean, they had, you know, nuclear bombs, and they were building missiles that could kill us all. They weren't as powerful as we thought they were, but they were still scary.
He paid a kind of physical price for carrying all this information so closely and privately and secretly, really.
A heart attack, a stroke, a stomach operation. He wasn't young. When he left office in 1961, he was the oldest president ever, first one to reach 70 in the Oval Office. Think of all the strain he'd been under all those years. He smoked 4 packs a day until 1949 when he gave himself an order to quit, as he put it, and did quit smoking. But he was beat up. He was worn out. By 1960, he was done.
That was my conversation with author Evan Thomas, who joined me in 2012 to discuss Eisenhower's role in the Cold War and his book, Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World. When we get back from the break, we'll hear my interview with author Joby Warrick about a Jordanian double agent and the CIA. This is the Top Secret edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. In 2009, Jordanian double agent Humam Khalil al-Balawi was invited to a secret CIA facility in Afghanistan. He was greeted by a group of agents who were so excited to meet him, they baked him a cake. It was a thank you for his help in delivering top al-Qaeda information. But the meeting turned deadly when al-Balawi detonated a suicide bomb. I spoke with Joby Warrick in 2011 about his book, The Triple Agent, the Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA, which profiled this mastermind behind the attack and how he deceived the CIA. Let's take a listen. This book, though, I have to say, swept me away. And let me just roll back the clock, as you actually do in the beginning of the book, back to 2007, 2008. This is the Bush administration and the CIA. How did they view al-Qaeda at that time?
It was a very difficult time because, as you remember, this is before the drone strikes really took off in earnest. And there was a period when Al-Qaeda was beginning to reorganize and regroup, and the CIA could see things going on. They could see meetings taking place. They could see plans starting to develop, recruits coming and going, some of them Europeans, Westerners who could get into the United States, into Western Europe with visas and passports. So it was an alarming time, and a decision was made in late 2008. We really have to strike these guys where they live. And so permission was given by the White House to start this very aggressive program of using these remote control planes, these drones, to hit Al-Qaeda wherever they could be found inside the sovereign territory of Pakistan. And so this is the backdrop in which things are beginning to happen when our story takes place.
Well, let's talk about this physician. And again, when we meet him in the book, he's actually being arrested. But let's talk about his work as a physician in Jordan. What kind of a doctor was he?
He's a pediatrician who works in a UN refugee clinic. He's Palestinian by background, grew up mostly in Jordan and somewhat in Kuwait when his family lived abroad for a while. But he's a very smart young man who goes to college abroad in Turkey, gets a medical degree, decides instead of working in a hospital or having some nice cushy clinic that he's going to work taking care of refugee mothers and children. So there's a very small, dilapidated UN clinic in one of these Palestinian refugee areas, and this is where he goes every day. But he's taking care of what he sees as his own people, the Palestinians, and he's sort of taking on their grievances and their complaints and their problems. Very angry. He's angry about what happened to the Palestinians, angry about the state of Israel, angry about the Western countries that support Israel. This is the beginning of a period that makes him quite agitated and wanting to do something to strike out in some way.
In fact, he comes as you becomes, as you describe, a cyber warrior for Islam. He has a different identity that he uses on the internet to send out these anti-American messages.
Right. So here's a man who's got no criminal background, no ties to terrorist groups, but he's angry. He wants to express himself in some way. So he develops this fake personality, goes on the web, and begins to write for these jihadist websites. And the next thing you know, he's becoming a celebrity in the jihadist blogosphere. He's writing, you know, diatribes about Americans in Iraq. He's writing about abuses of Palestinians and attacks on refugees in Gaza. And this is what makes him a problem, because suddenly there's this unknown person who's inciting people to violent things, and the Jordanian intelligence service, among others, want to find out who this is and stop him. So he does this all in secret until one day he's caught, and then everything changes.
Well, and he's caught and taken in for interrogation by Jordanian intelligence. How long do they hold him?
He's picked up in January of 2009. They take him into their interrogation center. The nickname for the place is the Fingernail Factory. Ooh. And it's very true that the place had that reputation. For Balawi, however, being this relatively soft guy who's working as a doctor who's never been in trouble before, he gets into this place. They blindfold him. They deprive him of sleep. And within a couple of days, he's completely broken down, and he's saying, I'll tell you whatever you want to know. And he's becoming very cooperative. And his handlers, or people who captured him, are sitting back and looking at him and thinking, you know, we've got a new helper potentially here. Mm-hmm. Let's see what he can do for us.
He describes, though, being not tortured or have his fingernails removed, but being humiliated. Do you think in that he was radicalized in any way by being shamed or humiliated?
When he goes back home, he tells his family that he was not tortured. He's, you know, they roughed me up a little bit, but his biggest complaint is they humiliated me. Mm. So here's someone who's an angry young man to begin with. He's feeling guilty because he's writing these things on the internet, but he's not really doing anything. Now he's at a state where he's back home and he's feeling, you know, emotionally, spiritually crushed because his enemy, as he's seen it, has captured him and they defeated him. So now he's more than ever trying to find some way to strike back.
Now, he is, in a sense, and I'm using quotations here, befriended by a Jordanian intelligence officer who begins to work with al-Balawi. First of all, describe that officer for us and help us understand what this relationship was about.
Into the scene walks this man who is quite exceptional by Jordanian standards. He's an intelligence officer and a very good one, but he also happens to be royalty. He's a cousin to the king of Jordan, King Abdullah II. And he becomes, just by happenstance, the case officer for Balawi. And his challenge is to try to turn this jihadist author into someone who can be useful for the Jordanians. They've got all kinds of problems. They've got Al-Qaeda, potentially Hezbollah, Hamas, lots of bad people coming and going. They'd like to be able to use this young doctor as a source. And so this long courtship begins in which Balawi is taken out to dinners and coffees, and they begin to probe and push, what can you do for us? Who can you help us get close to? And he begins to say, sure, I can help you out. I'm willing to go overseas to Pakistan and try to find the really big fish that you're looking for. So once the decision is made that this man is going to be sent to Pakistan, which if you think about it was unusual to say the least. He doesn't have any background in spying. He's not an agent in any sense that we would think of it, but he's willing to go. He seems to be attracted by the money, and he has potential in the sense that he could, because of his medical ability, he could end up making introductions and getting to know people, maybe learning things around the periphery. So it seemed like an okay idea, maybe not a home run, but something worth trying. And once he's set up to go to Pakistan, then the CIA becomes interested because they need people in this part of the world. They don't have enough human sources who are able to potentially get inside the Taliban's tent or figure out what Al-Qaeda might be doing. So they sign on as well. So by March 2009, this man has his passport and his visa. He's on his way to Pakistan under a pretense, and the Americans are now backing him. The new President Obama during the campaign has said, we're going to make a priority of finding bin Laden and killing him. The Bush administration had tried to do it. The Obama folks argue that they got sidetracked in Iraq. We're going to refocus our efforts on finding bin Laden. And so they were very happy to find anybody who could help in that cause. And Balawi was one of many who could potentially offer some help.
But let's talk about this outpost in Khost, Afghanistan. Can you describe that for our listeners?
It's not the place you want to go for a vacation. This is
indeed.
It is probably the worst of the worst areas in Afghanistan in terms of violence. It's a harsh place to live. And into the middle of this comes in 2001 and 2002, a group of CIA operatives who decided to use this logistics area as a staging point for them, for collecting intelligence, for running informants, for doing the various things they need to do. You know, the people who live there rarely go outside because it's too dangerous, but it becomes the home for scores and sometimes hundreds, depending on the mission, of CIA officers and special forces people who are there doing these jobs that most of us never really hear about.
And obviously when this event happens, headed up by a CIA officer, a woman named Jennifer Lynn Matthews, describe again for her listeners, I guess, what her credentials were and what she was doing there.
She's one of the most fascinating characters in this story. She's probably one of the best Al-Qaeda experts that the CIA has. She's been working on Al-Qaeda's case since before 9/11. She was one of the ones who were back at Langley arguing to the Bush administration, take these people seriously. They're coming to get us. This is a big problem. And was infuriated that nobody was paying attention. Because of her knowledge of Al-Qaeda, when key Al-Qaeda suspects were captured after 9/11, she was sent to some of these black sites, the CIA secret prisons that we hear about. So she was used to looking at high-level Al-Qaeda people and helping crack them, I guess is a good way to describe it. On the other hand, it's a completely different set of skills that are involved and needed to do something like running informants, you know, having people go to the other side, to the enemy camp, then come back and then evaluate their information and see if they're telling you the truth or not. There are people who are very good at that. She was very new at that.
So across the border in Pakistan, we have this physician, Al-Balawi, and part of his job was to convince Americans, his Jordanian handler, that he was indeed working for them?
Yes, and if you think about him, from his point of view, he's kind of walking this tightrope between two groups that don't really know what to make of him, because the Al-Qaeda and the folks on the Taliban side aren't quite sure who he is either. And there's a period of time where they're looking at him very carefully too, trying to figure out if he might be, in fact, a spy for the CIA. And in the meantime, he's beginning to deliver very important, very strikingly accurate and helpful intelligence reports to the CIA. And so over the summer of 2009, going into the fall, he goes from being this untested, untried, possible informant to becoming one of the best people out there in terms of the quality of the stuff he was producing. He was able to give real-time intelligence about what was going on in the tribal area. So when there was a drone strike, he was quickly on the scene because he was a doctor. He was often called upon to help out. So he would get back to the CIA and to the Jordanian handlers and say, okay, you've hit this target. This is who you killed. This is who got away. This is where they're moving to next. So he wasn't so much putting X's on people's backs as giving them real-time intelligence feeds about how the drone strikes were working. And it was stuff that the CIA could quickly check out because they had their own assets. They held drones flying over these places, and they could tell that he was telling the truth and he really was having the access that he was saying that he had.
So this was with the knowledge of al-Qaeda leadership and Taliban leadership?
Yes, and eventually, as they began to trust him, they began to test this out. Is this really working? Is the information getting back to the CIA? And clearly it was, because there was a feedback loop between the things that Bali was telling the CIA and the CIA's response. So he clearly had an open channel to Langley.
I mean, as it turns out, I guess he was too good to be true. But why did these red flags not impede the U.S. mission?
There are two things that were going on. One was just the level of sheer excitement about what this man was doing. Was he a real informant? Was he qualified to do this? It almost became irrelevant because what he was providing was so good. It seemed that the CIA had really gotten lucky. They'd struck gold. They'd sent somebody almost on a whim into Pakistan to do this highly improbable job of trying to get inside al-Qaeda. Yeah. And lo and behold, it was working. He was clearly there. He was clearly getting good information. And it was an opportunity they've been looking for a long time. So the excitement was just – it was building and became extreme. So that's one issue. And the other was there were people that didn't trust him and weren't sure that he was who he said he was, or if maybe he was just a con artist. Maybe he was just who knows if his information was correct or not. But they did all agree that they had to meet with him, because when it became clear to people in Langley that no American had ever set eyes on this agent, it behooved all of them to try to at least set up a meeting where they can evaluate him, look him in the eye, check him out to see if they thought he was lying, and then to see what they could do next with him. So this is what motivated in late December 2009 this fateful meeting, bringing together this incredibly productive agent with American CIA officers for the first time.
So he is driving towards his post in coast Afghanistan, and as you describe, the Americans and others waiting there for him are, in a sense, eager for his arrival, and they bake him a cake.
There's a well-known tradition in the Arabic culture for hospitality. You have to show, graciousness towards your guest, and as he arrived, the cake has literally been baked and it's being walked over to this meeting area.
Joby, if you could describe for us what transpired that day. And it was a violent explosion. He has a bomb vest on, obviously blowing himself up, but the devastation is extraordinary.
Yes, and it's also amazing that he manages to get into the base without being searched. And that's done because he has an Afghan escort, somebody that the CIA sent to pick him up. The agency is worried about spies. They're worried that there might be Taliban informants lurking around the front of the base. There may be people looking through telescopes or binoculars. And so no one checks him, pats him down, looks at him for wires or anything else until he gets all the way into the CIA portion of the base where it's very limited, very restricted access. And when he's there, he's got not just your standard suicide bomb, because they knew this might be a really big deal.
Right.
He had a 30-pound, munition on his chest, which had military explosive, the C4, very powerful stuff, and tons of shrapnel, just the ball bearings, metal fragments that were designed to go in every direction and kill as many people as he possibly could. So this is how he shows up at the base on the day of the meeting.
And did al-Qaeda, Taliban, did they see this as both a tactical victory, but a victory of public relations as well?
They did. In fact, they fought over who could claim the credit for this. The Taliban wanted to claim credit. Al-Qaeda core claimed credit for it. Everybody thought this was a terrific mission, because it doesn't often happen that you can strike and kill CIA officers. But here they had a chance to get into a CIA facility and kill seven Americans, which is the most casualties in any single incident since 1983. This is a very big deal for them.
You also, though, write about al-Balawi's perhaps second thoughts. He questioned his decision to be a suicide bomber, and it looks like he was perhaps a reluctant suicide bomber.
Yeah, that's one of the striking things about the material for this book is it's often very hard to read the mind of a suicide bomber. But Balawi, being this educated person, being someone who's somewhat Western-oriented, approached this mission very logically, and he sat down and wrote on paper his thoughts about going into a suicide mission. He said, you know, I've often wondered what people think about, well, I'm about to give the benefit to others because I'm going to tell you what I'm thinking. And so he talked about how he worried about the fact this might just be a waste. He might never get inside the base. Or if he blows himself up, that's the only thing he'll ever be able to do for jihad. Is this the best way to use his talents? Mm. And he worried about his family and about his wife and his children and who would take care of him, his father who was elderly. And he went down this long list of things that troubled him. And yet he decided at the end that this was his lot. This is what Allah wanted him to do. And was in the presence of these officers, he began to chant the death prayer, God is great, hit a detonator, and there was a massive explosion that killed or wounded everybody that was within eyesight of him. Two of the Americans died in helicopters on the way to a hospital, including Jennifer Matthews, the base chief.
What effect then on the CIA when this happened?
This was devastating because it's not just the loss of life, which for them was extreme. You know, we hear about soldiers being killed all the time in Afghanistan. This doesn't happen in the CIA's world, and it certainly doesn't happen with so many people. So this was devastating in that sense. And also they lost a lot of institutional knowledge. They had some of their best al-Qaeda experts present that day. So that was very difficult to replace. And at the same time, this was not something that caused the CIA to shirk or to say, we're going to pull back or this is too risky. And they did quite the opposite, and the base was restaffed very quickly, and then they began this very intense campaign of striking back. The pace of drone strikes in the few weeks after the coast bombing was higher than anything that ever had taken place before or since.
That was my 2011 interview with Joby Warrick, author of The Triple Agent, the al-Qaeda mole who infiltrated the CIA. Warrick's new book is Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. And when we return, we'll listen to my conversation with author Scott Johnson about how he learned that his father worked for the CIA. Stay with us. This is the top secret edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Every child fears the moment when a parent says, we need to talk. Scott Johnson's father made a startling confession when Scott was a teenager that he had been a longtime special agent with the CIA. Johnson struggled to come to terms with his father's true identity and what it meant for their relationship. He's worked as a journalist and joined us a few years ago to discuss his memoir, The Wolf and the Watchman, A Father, a Son, and the CIA.
I mean, in a certain way, you were sworn to secrecy as well. I mean, in a way, became a kind of a co-conspirator with your dad.
Yeah, absolutely. And at first, you know, that was really exciting because I thought, geez, you know, I am now in on the big story, as it were, this huge compelling secret, and that was incredibly exciting. But over time, the reality of that started to sink in, and I realized, well, okay. And he told me, you know, you cannot tell anybody.
Right.
And
that's a big secret for a kid to
it
hold
is.
On to.
Yeah, it's a big secret, and it involves lying to your friends and sometimes your family, and kind of really, yeah, it's a big deal.
He said to you, or in the book he says to you a number of times, I love you more than the sky. I mean, he seemed to have a very passionate, intense love for you, his son.
Yeah, he did, and he still does. We've always had a really close relationship. I think for him, and I say this in the book at one point, that I think his love for me was the sort of pure thing that he could have in his life, in a life that was already very complicated by sort of moral, psychological, and even physical dangers of one sort or another. And, you know, so having me in his life was just this wonderful thing. And I don't say that in an egotistical way. I think it's just how it was, and I felt the same way.
The same kind of purity that you could love your father so overtly in a way?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, he's an incredibly affectionate, loving man, and I think that closeness and that sort of intimacy in a way is what oddly generated some of this later discomfort that I had about his line of work and our relationship, because I thought, well, if we are so close and yet at the same time there are these huge portions of his life that are just totally off limits to me, what does that mean for our relationship, and how do both of us understand that?
I mean, kind of omerta in a way, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, like a mafia family.
I mean, I didn't want to go too far on that. But.
Sure, but I think the similarities are there, or really anybody in a line of work where there's a tremendous amount of secrecy and you have to live a double life.
Well, after you have this conversation, he goes into Apex Insurance, into this, which was not, it's really, a, it was a front for the CIA, and this was in Detroit. What were his other, I guess, cover jobs that he had?
Yeah, so Apex Insurance was the physical address that we had there, or that he had there. And then to different people, we had different cover stories. I mean, at that time, he told people that he worked, I think, for the Commerce Department. He was just a sort of bureaucrat for the Commerce Department. And then at various other postings, you know, he was a consular officer in the embassy or a political officer. For a while, when we lived on a secret base, he was a teacher. So there were a number of different, you know, cover jobs that we had to assume. You know, we had to assume that, like body snatchers.
Well, and for a time in Mexico, he was dean of men at the University of the Americas.
Yeah, that's right. Now, of course, that was before he was recruited into the CIA. That was actually his real job.
A real job. That
yeah,
he had.
Right.
This is gets confusing, doesn't
yeah.
it? What's real and what isn't?
Right. So that was his job in 1968. He was a teacher, a professor at the University of Americas. He taught political science. And he was also the dean of men, so he was responsible for sort of student affairs and when they got in trouble or arrested for doing drugs or things like that. And it was in his capacity as dean of men that he became embroiled in this very sort of complex plot at the time to whereby the KGB was trying to infiltrate the university.
And why was he recruited, or how did he get recruited?
So those days in Mexico were really a turbulent time. There was a lot of student protesting going on, and the Cold War was at its apex, of course. And Mexico City was this tremendously important battlefield in that war. And so both the Americans and the Soviets were trying to kind of recruit, you know, one another in sensitive positions. And my father found himself in the middle of a plot that the Soviets had staged to recruit student activists at this university who might be interested in staging protests against the Americans or, you know, things like that. So one of his students kind of got in over his head, and my father saw this happening, and he decided that, well, this wasn't good for the student, but in fact, it might be good for him.
Yes.
So he sort of inserted himself into the equation in a way and found it very enjoyable. And that, of course, led to his connection with the CIA, and then they were very pleased with him and went about recruiting him.
Well, and not to give too much away, later on, there, I guess she was a girlfriend, Sophia.
Yes.
Someone that you knew. And you began to piece together, you know, how much was your dad implicated in some of the things that happened in Mexico at the time?
Yeah, so this was a little bit later in my career. I'd already been a journalist for a while, and I had started this process of questioning of my dad. You know, what had he actually been up to before I was even born? And who was this man? And did I really know him and trust him as I had believed for so much of my life? And then I met this woman in Mexico who had a kind of a similar history in terms of the omerta that you alluded to earlier. Mm. Her father, of course, had been on the other side of the equation, and he had been a guerrilla, a sympathizer, a Stalinist with these rebel groups. And the Mexican government had caught him, sent him away to prison for 4 years. And it was the exact same year that my father was recruited into the CIA. So I started to think, geez, maybe there's more here. And when I told her about my experience, she was just shattered because it brought up all these traumatic memories in her own life.
Did you out your father in this book? I mean, I know the CIA is very careful about, you know, members of the CIA writing about their lives.
No, I didn't. He had been out for a while. He actually ran a political campaign in the late 90s after he had officially retired from the agency. And once he had retired, of course, he was able to say what he did. But the political campaign brought a lot of that out in a very public way, because he ran as a Democrat, and the Republican Party actually ran a hit campaign, ironically, against him because of his affiliation with the CIA.
You lived in a number of places, and one that just seemed so exotic was in New Delhi. And what did your dad, quote unquote, do in New Delhi?
He was a consular officer.
A consular officer, which is a sort of generic cover anything. But he would go to work every day?
Sure, yeah. He would go to sort of two jobs. Sometimes he would pop in and do work as a consular officer to maintain the cover. And then he would carry out his espionage work at other times, both during the normal working hours, but then also off hours at night, you know, going on drives to meet agents or do dead drops. So it was sort of doing double time. And a lot of the CIA work is kind of a lifestyle in that sense, because you're always on.
Yeah.
Everybody you meet is potentially a recruit, somebody who could provide you with valuable information, somebody who could, you know, maybe introduce you to somebody else who could do that. So parties, both at other people's homes and at our home. And of course, this opened the door to all kinds of people coming into our house. And then, as you see in the book, there were, you know, sometimes threats against us.
Yeah. In fact, it looked like you were nearly kidnapped.
Yes. Yeah. For a while. You have to read the book.
But do you think you became a journalist because your dad was a spy?
I think subconsciously it definitely played into it. At the time, it just seemed like a really exciting life, and it turned out that it really was.
Yes.
But I just loved the life. I loved the, telling stories and traveling and just being in the midst of this, as they say, the first draft of history. It was incredibly intoxicating. But at a deeper level, and I came to realize this over time, there was this really powerful force at work, which was a desire to tell the truth about things, because so much of my childhood had been about keeping secrets and keeping the truth at bay and not letting other people in to my secret. So the possibility that there was a life where that was encouraged and validated, that was really tremendous.
You write in your book that at some point you began hearing voices. But as you say, you know, you weren't hearing strange people's voices. In a sense, you were hearing your own voice. Do you think it was sort of part of this conversation you were having with yourself to try to figure out who your dad was, what was real, what wasn't?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the sort of things that you engage in, I guess, as a kid doing this is that there's a lot of meticulousness, and you have to be careful about what you say and to whom you say it, how you say it even. And so that meticulousness about presentation kind of crept into my mind. And I'm not saying it was all due to my father's job, but I think maybe some of it was. And also it was sort of tinged with a moral tone. You know, am I a good person? Am I a bad person? Who am I? Where do I fit in? And so when I talk about this voice, it was sort of a very powerful inner critic, I suppose, to use a therapeutic term. After I returned from my first major stint in Iraq, which was about a 7-month period during the invasion, I had had a very, very close scrape with death, actually. I had been ambushed. And then I proceeded to stay there and report for 7 months. And I returned from that just really kind of a wreck. And that was when I saw the psychiatrist. And so I was having kind of PTSD issues, but combined with this very powerful, you know, inner critic voice. And it kind of led to a breakdown of sorts. And so he told me that.
Well, I can only imagine. I mean, you know, I work in this hermetically sealed room here. I've never, as I said before on the show, I've never risked my life for a story. But you were in Iraq during the real height of the civil war, the sectarian violence that was just exploding in certain parts of that country.
Yeah, so I was a bureau chief for Newsweek there in 2005 and 2006, which were the height of the troubles. There were killings, massacres every day. It was an incredibly risky time, and I salute any other journalist who was there at that time. It was a really tough time.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I lived there for 2 years reporting on the, you know, the disintegration of that country.
And sort of living it and reporting on it and experiencing it as well, right?
Yeah.
You just have to be in this constant state of alertness.
Oh, absolutely. And, one of the interesting things, and I think other correspondents can certainly relate to this, is that when you're in the midst of something like that, it's so intense and so all-consuming, literally. It's day and night. You know, you're working 24 hours a day, really, except for when you're sleeping, but all the time. And you always sort of feel for your life. We would have mortars and rockets come in and land, you know, very close to our house. Going out into the streets was sometimes very dangerous. And so, you know, when you're there, you're thinking, okay, as soon as I get out of here, everything's going to be fine and I'm going to return to normal. But in fact, it's just the opposite, because as soon as you get out, your defenses start to come down, and then all of that kind of built-up trauma and tension starts to overwhelm you. And veterans of the military and also journalists will tell you the exact same thing. It's always when you are out, when you return, that the trauma of the whole experience starts to sort of wash over you.
Did your dad worry about you?
He did. He worried about me, of course, when I was there. We would have long conversations about it. He was, you know, he was proud and happy that I was doing something that I enjoyed doing, but he was tremendously worried. And of course, when I got out, you know, he would, he wondered, you know, whether I had PTSD and so on. Mm. At that time, PTSD was still kind of emerging into the public consciousness. Now we know a lot more about it.
He, as you write, would feed you stories as well. I mean, give you ideas for stories.
Yeah, he would, because he was really well versed in foreign affairs and the history of these different places. And he would, you know, he would say, hey, you know, why don't you look into this or ask me questions? What's happening here? And he knew all the intricacies. You know, what are the Sunnis doing? And what does this faction say? And what about this particular politician? He followed it like a hawk.
Did your fellow journalists know that your dad had worked for the CIA?
No. No, that was something that I kept on, as they say, the down low. I didn't want to. I didn't really.
It's another use of that word, but yes.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I really didn't want to advertise that widely or publicly at all, both for my own credibility. I didn't want to be seen as a journalist who had somehow, you know, connections.
Baggage, maybe.
Baggage,
even.
Yeah, and dubious connections. I thought it would harm my own reputation, and perhaps it would have. And I also just, I was aware because of my own childhood that if I came out with something like that, people around me could also be affected, as my father had taught me.
That was my conversation with author Scott Johnson, who joined me in 2013 to discuss his relationship with his father, who worked as a CIA special agent throughout his childhood. His book is The Wolf and the Watchman. And that does it for this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Write us at radiotimes@whyy.org and tell us what you think of the show. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits this show, with assistance this week from Diana Allen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.